From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. And now, the weather. A nasty heat wave is spreading across the country right now. Forecasts are for dangerous heat and humidity across much of the lower 48 for the next week. Warnings and advisories in effect for at least 22 states and Washington, D.C. But think about it. How do we know? How do meteorologists look at the 5 quadrillion tons of air that make up the global atmosphere, subject to perturbations, both micro and macro? How do they wrestle any certainty out of that chaos to give us a weather forecast? Well, it turns out it's a story of audacious thinking and unparalleled international cooperation. So this hour on Point, the history and science of the weather forecast. And you can join us. Do you depend on your local meteorologist to decide, help you decide what to wear, whether to bike, take the bus? And if you live in places like, say, Tornado Alley, has the weather forecast saved your life? Do you rely more these days, though, on weather apps than the television weather reports? And as we enter an era of more extreme weather, are the accuracies of these weather reports more important than ever? I guess that one is a rhetorical question. Join us online anytime, Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio, or on our website at onpointradio.org. Well, the story, the history of the weather forecast is told in a fascinating new book titled The Weather Machine, A Journey Inside the Forecast. It's by Andrew Blum, and he joins us today from New York. Andrew, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
So first of all, I was wondering if you might tell us of your own personal experience that really got you thinking about the science of a weather report that had to do with weathering. Sorry, that's a terrible pun, but Superstorm Sandy. What happened to you?
Yeah, so it's 2012, October. My son had just been born. He was about 6 weeks old, and I was spending a lot of time sitting in a chair with him in one hand and with my phone looking at Twitter in the other. And it was a Sunday afternoon when kind of all at once the meteorologists that I follow sort of they all went kind of crazy. And what had popped up on their screens was a storm that wasn't due to arrive in New York for another 8 days until the following Monday evening. And that storm became Sandy, and it arrived and was incredibly consequential in New York and in the region. But what amazed me as I began to think about it was that, you know, this couldn't possibly be based on their intuition. This wasn't about their own pattern matching or sort of, you know, looking at their different data sources. It had to come directly from the supercomputer models that really are driving forecasting today. And when I tried to understand how they worked, what they were made of, it was really a black box. And I kind of set out to peer inside, to pull back the curtain and see what they were made of.
Well, but you write, again, early in your book, that Sandy revealed, as you say, a paradigm shift in weather forecasting. Why is that?
Well, these models had gotten so good. Eight days was really beyond human comprehension. And I realized that it wasn't about the skills of the people. It wasn't about the skills of the meteorologists, but rather about the tool that they were using. And of course, the people who made that tool, the sort of model makers who had really succeeded in creating a simulation of the atmosphere far beyond the capabilities that I had given it credit for.
Yeah. So even with in the era of supercomputing driving what the weather forecasts are, it's still obviously a science of high variability. Mm-hmm. But take us back in time, though. When did we first shift from, you know, the farmer's almanac or relying on local observations to this notion that we could actually predict the future based on global atmospheric patterns?
There might still be some who swear by the farmer's almanac, yeah. But I wouldn't recommend it. It really began with the telegraph. I mean, you can't talk about knowing what the weather is going to be in one place at many times unless you know what the weather is in many places at one time. And that was really the key. It was this sort of beginnings of the national telegraph system, and the telegraph operators would tap out to each other what the conditions were in their different places. And soon enough, people began to draw maps, to sort of draw regional and national maps of the weather. And you could then begin to recognize the way in which storms were moving across the country. You couldn't predict how they would evolve or how they would change or transform, but you could definitely have some sort of early indication that they were, that, you know, particularly these, you know, kind of storms we get this time of year with, you know, big thunderstorms racing across. And so that those first inklings of that national map was really the first step needed.
Of course, but the telegraph could be disrupted, though.
Yeah, well, it was actually handy because the first early telegraphs didn't work very well in the rain. So if they couldn't hear from their counterparts, you know, a few hundred miles away, then they could be sure that there might be rain on the line.
Okay. Well, so you tell so many interesting stories in this book, and let's spend some time with how the weather, or the importance of the weather and the importance of being able to predict it, played out in the Second World War, actually. So moving forward a century here from the mid 19th century and the telegraph. I'm going to bounce around here a little bit, but I just found these Second World War stories so fascinating. Tell us about how important the weather was, or understanding the weather was, for the Nazis, because they actually had a secret mission in Canada, which I had literally never heard of before I read your book.
No, it's a crazy story. Well, to back up a little bit as well, you know, before the war and up to the war, you have this incredible international exchange of weather observations. And there's a lot of cooperation among meteorologists to share their data. But of course, that fragments when the war begins, and weather becomes a really sort of very strategic, and knowing what the weather is going to be becomes very strategic. And the Nazis were at a disadvantage, particularly in the Atlantic, because the storms are mostly coming from the north and west, and that the sort of north and west coasts of the Atlantic were not Nazi territory. So they did all they could to collect observations from these places that they used to sort of get as a matter of courtesy from Canadian meteorologists, but no longer did. And when things got particularly desperate, when they realized that they had to, you know, that this was very consequential for their fleets in the Atlantic, they went so far as to invent a new kind of weather station. It was done by the predecessor of the Siemens Corporation that kind of still exists. And it was it had a high mast and a radio, and it was basically a kind of little robot that they put in the front of a U-boat and sailed across the Atlantic and hauled it up on a ridge present day Labrador, and then sort of way northern coast of Canada. And from there, it transmitted the temperature and the humidity ostensibly across all the way to Europe, and could then be used to make the same kind of maps that were fragmented by this loss of the weather exchange. It only worked for about 2 weeks. That either the batteries failed or it was perhaps jammed, and then it sat there. It was undiscovered until the late 70s. They had written the Nazis had written Canadian Meteor Service literally on the can, and sort of strewn American cigarette packs around, and that actually seemed to have worked for a period of time. It had been stumbled upon before and just kind of ignored.
I mean, that one was quite an eye-opener. The Canadian Meteor Service part I loved. But more seriously, another example is, for example, the Allies having to understand, or having an edge in their understanding of predicting the weather in deciding whether or not to launch the D-Day landings.
Yeah. You know, it's one of the things that meteorologists love to point out is that a forecast is only as good as the decisions you can make from it. You know, this a sort of perfect technical forecast means nothing. It's all about how it helps us. And with the D-Day story, the forecast was good enough to convince Eisenhower to postpone the invasion by a day. That the U.S. and British meteorologists recognized that while the weather was stormy, there was going to be a break in the storms that morning of June 6, 1944. And so based on that one-day forecast, that decision was made, and obviously it was incredibly consequential.
Wow. Well, and I mean, since we mentioned it, here is a little sound from a newsreel describing that day, the 6th of June, 1944. Operation Overlord, as it was officially known, better known as D-Day, began on the 6th of June. And here's a newsreel describing the Allied invasion of the Normandy coast.
Vast squadrons of bombers and transports led the way, more than 11,000 planes spearheading the attack. Paratroopers landed in Normandy behind the coastal defenses. Landings made with timing and precision, barges approached shore ready for instant action, some bearing artillery and rocket guns already opening fire.
Newsreel sound from the D-Day invasion, and of course, landings made with timing and precision, and precision in the weather forecasting that gave the Allies an edge there. But Andrew Blum, the whole point of being able to predict the weather, it rests on the assumption or the understanding that we can understand patterns in the atmosphere, right? That there is a way to wrestle certainty out of that chaos. When did we first come to that? When did humanity first come to that critical understanding? I mean, you write about a Norwegian physicist in the 19th century. Who was he and why was he so important?
Yeah, Wilhelm Bjerknes, who's a Norwegian physicist and mathematician. And what he recognized, he came to meteorology a little bit late. He really wanted to be a kind of famous physicist. This was the moment of Einstein as well. But he realized that if you could calculate fluids in the atmosphere or get the atmosphere as a fluid and use the equations of physics and of thermodynamics, each of those calculations was its own kind of hypothesis. And you could be proven right if you could observe the atmosphere enough. You could be proven right or wrong each day. And so you can kind of think of the weather forecast not as a kind of, not as based on observations or storm chasing, but rather based on, real quantitative measurement and know exactly how right you were, how wrong you were, and tweak it again. And so you had this kind of daily science experiment. But of course, and he went so far as to successfully kind of write down the equations that would make this happen. Meteorologists today refer to them as the primitive equations. But of course, he had no way to calculate them. There was an English mathematician who came after him, a guy named Lewis Fry Richardson, who thought that he would actually give it a try. But when he tried to, when he sort of did the math of what it would take to calculate the atmosphere within enough time to make a useful forecast, which is to say before the future that you were predicting actually came, he realized that he would need 64,000 people, human computers in a stadium to do it fast enough.
Well, we'll talk more about Richardson in just a moment, but we're talking this hour with Andrew Blum. He has a new book out. It's a fascinating book called The Weather Machine, A Journey Inside the Forecast, and we have an excerpt of it at onpointradio.org. And we want to hear from you. Predicting the weather has become more accurate over time with the use of supercomputers especially, but are you relying more on apps or the television? And why do you think we still can't fully get that 10-day forecast just right? This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour with Andrew Blum. He has a new book out. It's called The Weather Machine, A Journey Inside the Forecast, where he talks about the science and history of how we predict the weather. And Andrew, we've got some comments coming in on our website, onpointradio.org. Mike L. says, a magic eight ball, a roll of the dice, a shopping plaza psychic, a Doppler radar, and a lucky guess, Ben Franklin's almanac, a Ouija board, the local voodoo priestess, my Bubba's aching joints, # things used to predict the weather. Now, come on, Mike, LOL. We're actually going to talk about the science here of how we predict the weather. And before the break, Andrew, you had mentioned a British mathematician named Lewis Fry Richardson. And tell us more about his particular breakthrough. It wasn't just trying to wrestle down all these complex equations that describe the atmosphere, but something fundamental in a sort of a structure in how we view how the atmosphere works, that he envisioned columns of air all around the world, and that if we understood what was the dynamics in each one of those columns of air, we could somehow bring all that together to understand the weather. Do I have that right?
Yeah. I mean, the key thing is that you can't know what the weather of the future will be unless you know the weather of the present. And so it's this, ongoing, 150 or millennia old effort to measure the atmosphere in as many places as possible, or in as many places as your computations can handle, as a starting point for be able to run it forward faster in time. And, you know, do this sort of everyday time travel that we kind of, you know, just listen to in the morning.
Right. So he just didn't – so he had the concept right but didn't have the computational power. But what? In the 1950s, that's when we start entering the world of computers. So how much – what a difference did that make?
It started, you know, one of the first uses of the first computer was to try to calculate these weather equations. But again, you ran up against this question of can you do it fast enough to be useful? And that was a question that even, you know, Wilhelm Bjerknes had articulated right from the very beginning. You know, what use, he says, is doing this unless we can do it before it actually happens? And so it really isn't until the 70s and the 80s that these computer weather models begin to become useful, which is to say, more skillful, as the meteorologists like to say, than the meteorologists themselves. And at that point, they start being referred to as guidance. They are guiding meteorologists. They are sort of one data source that the humans are using to begin to say what's going to happen next. But each decade, and this is the way the meteorologists talk about it, each decade, the forecast improved by a day. So a one-day forecast in 1980, then by 1990, was a two-day forecast was just as good. And that has continued. So really you can say that today's six-day forecast is as good as a five-day forecast 10 years ago, a four-day forecast 20 years ago. And at that point, you know, we've sort of have liftoff. At that point, we're beyond, we're relying on the models to see patterns and predict the weather far beyond the ability of humans. And you see it. I saw it this week on Monday afternoon. Suddenly, the kind of news broke that we would have record breaking heat this weekend, mm-hmm. and that that was sort of announced because because the models said so. It wasn't about the kind of human recognition. It was about what the supercomputer had spit out, and everybody takes it seriously. We trust it now, and sure enough, it seems to be accurate for the weekend.
Well, Honest Debate 2 on our website says that by comparing weather forecasts with the actual weather, I have discovered they're pretty good for about 3 days, says Honest Debate 2. 10 days out, no one knows anything. But Andrew, it seems like you're saying with the passage of time, we might have a pretty accurate 10-day forecast.
Yeah, and of course it depends what's going on. You know, the best weather model in the world comes from the European Center for Medium Range Weather Forecasts, and they have talked about not only keeping this pace of improving the model by a day a decade, but actually increasing that rate. So they're hoping to forecast extreme events 14 days in advance by 2025. So they had Sandy 8 days in advance in 2012. So that's a pretty remarkable increase.
Okay, so you mentioned the European Center for Medium Range Weather Forecast. So let's talk a little bit about where the different models are coming from. And in order to do that, I just want to listen to a moment here. This is Hank Allen, meteorologist for New Orleans ABC affiliate WGNO, and he's looking at the forecast for viewers as Hurricane Barry approached the Louisiana coast last weekend. Now, in this clip, you'll notice how Hank Allen uses both the European forecasting model and the American one to guess the storm's impact.
Now, I've switched this over here from the European model because I think that was a little low. Back on the Weather Prediction Center rainfall potential, that is the man-made product now that the Weather Prediction Center puts out. Still same basic theme, though. You have the higher rainfall amounts here through the Echafly up through Baton Rouge, 10 to 15 inches. Significant flash flood potential still there. Significant river flooding potential there. So as it stands right now, New Orleans still, I think, we're in that sort of 3 to 6 inch range here over the next 2 to 3 days.
That's Hank Allen from WGNO in New Orleans. So Andrew Blum, explain this for a second here, because obviously meteorologists like Hank have to come to a conclusion, but they're using models generated in different places. So the Weather Prediction Center versus the quote-unquote European model, what is he talking about?
Yeah, it's a great clip. I love how he refers to the man-made product versus the models. I think that really speaks to the distinction. And it has been a paradigm shift, but we're still at a moment of transition. We're relying on the different supercomputer models, and so there's the European Center, which is by a smidgen the most accurate sort of statistically over time, and then there's the American version called the GFS. And, they compete against each other and they do similar things. And they're both global weather models. So they model the entire atmosphere of the Earth. And I guess the really important thing to recognize is that they are kind of ongoing concerns. They are ongoing simulations of the atmosphere with the special ability to be run forward faster in time. And it's really not about, you know, sort of putting the weather of the present in and sort of crunching it out to the weather of the future. And it's certainly not about using past weather to predict future weather, but rather it's about making a simulation that most closely matches the actual atmosphere as we can observe it. And so when you, you know, but at this sort of moment we're at in weather history, there's still, you know, there's still the need to kind of look at multiple models, you know, scratch your chin and say, I think this is the one that's going to be right. And that actually interests me a lot because you have these very carefully calibrated systems that are all about the sort of daily verification of what they can do. And then between the models and us, you do have still a human who is making you know, an informed but still more intuitive response to what's going to happen. And I think you know, I think that's you know, I think the competition between models is interesting, but it indicates that we sort of have these meshing gears between these, you know, really complex automated systems and the human meteorologists whose job it is not only to interpret them but to also recognize what impact they will have, and of course always that crucial piece to help us make decisions based on their outputs.
Right. We'll talk about that piece in a minute here, but basic question, are these various weather centers, are they getting their data from the same places and just putting them through different models?
Yeah, so it's, you know, if you've got a global model, you need global data.
Yeah.
And for global data, you need a lot of cooperation from, you know, from every, you know, every country on Earth, basically. You know, and it's has always, for its over its 150-year history, weather observations have primarily been the task of governments. But with the models today, and really where a lot of the sort of incredible breakthrough the last, you know, 20, 30 years has come, a lot of the vast majority, the sort of 90% of the data that goes in on a daily basis and is used by the models comes from one kind of satellite, the polar orbiting satellites. And it's not even the sort of weather satellites as we think of them. It's not the ones that give us the pictures that we're used to seeing, which are incredibly useful for particularly for sort of shorter range forecasts. It's the polar orbiters that collect mostly quantitative data that can mostly be read not by humans but by the supercomputers that are really giving us this sort of deeper look into the future, this 3, 4, 5, you know, 8-day look.
Okay. So we're going to come back to this in just a second, and we'll also hear from a meteorologist as well. But I do want to turn to our callers. We're talking this hour with Andrew Blum. He is author of a new book called The Weather Machine, A Journey Inside the Forecast. And we're at 800-423-8255. So let's go to Donna first, who's calling from Memphis, Missouri. Donna, you're on the air.
Hi. I do have a comment about using the apps more than television and the meteorologist kind of prediction. I travel a lot, and I check the app before I go, and at least twice this month, the apps have, I think, saved me from probably physical harm, because the forecast, which I also check before I take off on any kind of trip, the forecast was no rain, it's going to be calm, and again, we're here in the Midwest. Yesterday was one, the most recent example, there was a squall line that just developed out of nowhere. And all of a sudden we had hail and 60 mile an hour winds, and the app, come up with a little warning, you know, like, it's going to happen in the next 45 minutes, take cover right now.
Yeah.
And so of course you do. And that happened 2 weeks ago as well, when I was traveling in Oklahoma and Tornado Alley there. You're always really, really aware of, and need to be aware of where you are and the apps. So I don't know. It's just so much better than the TV or the meteor. It seems to be to me. It saves me a lot.
All right. Well, Donna, thank you so much for your call. So Andrew Blum, Donna at least saying that the apps, weather apps are more useful to her than the weather report she might see on the TV. I mean, is that because the apps, are they not just drawing from that global information you're talking about, but also from like local weather stations as well?
No, I think the real important distinction to draw is between the weather models, which are the kind of the supercomputer systems that are run primarily by national weather services and by consortia weather services like the European Center, and the apps, which are sort of drawing often from a kind of blend of those different models and then adding their own sort of special statistical sauce that, you know, that might sort of try to make them more precise for given locations, you know, to sort of, you know, if it's going to be cooler at the beach or in the middle of the city or something like that. But I think, you know, it's really about recognizing that there is this global modeling system that everybody's drawing on, both the TV meteorologists as well as the apps. And I think, you know, the thing that we're still working out, both the humans as well as the apps, is how to draw the most out of those predictions. Because, you know, sometimes the models spit out a future with a lot of confidence in a given place. They say, we're sure the storm is coming, or we're not sure the storm is coming. But sometimes the forecast, of course, is for, you know, it might rain. And I think the recognition that sort of not every day is going to be equal and not every day is going to be exactly right. And we have to kind of, you know, recognize that if there's a probability of something happening, we might, depending on the consequences, want to make a certain decision based on that probability.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk to someone who does this day in and day out for a television audience. Bree Eggers joins us now. She's with us from Boise, Idaho. She's a meteorologist at Boise's NBC affiliate KTVB. She's a member of the American Meteorological Society. They just had their annual conference in May, and Bree Eggers is also a member of the National Weather Association. Welcome to On Point, Bree.
Hi, thanks for having me.
It's great to have you. So you've heard Andrew walk us through some of the history of how we got to sort of modern-day meteorology. Can you tell us how you use all this to provide a weather forecast day in and day out to the folks in Boise? How do you do what you do?
Well, I allow myself time to come in every day and put together my forecast before our shows will begin. You know, we have our shows at 5, 6, 10 p.m. during the day. And so it is the TV aspect that I'm focused on, that 2 to maybe 3 minute forecast. I only get 2 to 3 minutes to talk about what the forecast is going to be in any half hour to hour long newscast. So there's part of my day, but then to put together the forecast for that on-air 2 to 3 minutes, I allow myself, say, an hour to 90 minutes to put together that forecast. It's still such a limited amount of time to look at all of that data that Andrew's been talking about, everything that we have available to us. And, yeah, forecast models are fantastic. They're amazing. We use them every day. But it does take an operator to kind of decide, and Andrew's touched on this as well, decide, is it correct? Is that functioning in the right way? Is that taking the data available to us, what the weather is like right now, and giving us a good picture of what it might be like in the future? But again, that's all limited to maybe an hour. I get to pore over that data to put together my forecast.
Yeah, and so what are the sources that you're turning to for that data to churn through?
There are a lot of different services available online. A lot of them are subscriptions that you can buy to be able to have access to, say, the Euro Ensemble, which will be a bunch of different runs of the Euro model and all kind of taking the average of what that model is showing us. It's taken different parts of that forecast out or put them in and run it out several times and given us an average of what's going on. So I have a couple of weather sites that I go to online. I think a lot of them are free. I think Andrew even touched on this in his book, that you can access the Euro model for not paying for a subscription from anywhere in the world, mm-hmm. if you're interested.
And so are you finding, though, that we had the caller calling from Missouri who said that she loves the weather apps, that they were more useful to her than what she sees on television. So are you finding now, Bree, that there's, I don't want to, maybe it's competition from the weather apps, or that as a TV meteorologist that you need to provide a different kind of information, not just, you know, like a 40% chance of rain in Boise tomorrow, but like, here's what you ought to do with this weather information.
Right, absolutely. We talked a lot about that at the broadcast conference in San Diego for the American Meteorological Society, that we do have the job now to offer more than what the app is doing. However, I do think that apps are great because it is a computer that you're able to access any time of the day. I work a full-time job. I'm only there for, you know, an eight-hour shift, say, 40 hours a week. And I'm only on TV for 2 to 3 minutes a day, and you have to wait for my show to start at 5 p.m. to see what the forecast, what Bree is going to say in the forecast. Where you can access the app at any point in the day, it'll even alert you if you set up those features. However, what I'm doing in my forecast is I'm explaining it in more detail. Why is it happening? Why did I come to this conclusion by looking at the forecast models myself? What do we need to do at this point? You know, and I think another interesting thing that was touched on in severe weather season, James Spann down in Alabama, he's the leader on covering severe weather, and he mentioned that not a lot of people know where they're located. They can't just look at a map and know that if a storm's moving southeast, it's moving in their direction. So I think that's another thing that a human can offer that perhaps a computer can't, is really almost like sitting down in a coffee shop with a friend and explaining, this is what's happening, this is why it's happening, and this is what's going to happen in the future.
Well, Bree Eggers, meteorologist at Boise's NBC affiliate KTVB, stand by for just a second, and Andrew Blum, hang on as well. Andrew's the author of The Weather Machine, A Journey Inside the Forecast. We got to take a quick break. We'll be right back. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour about the science and history of the weather forecast, and our conversation is based on a terrific new book from Andrew Blum, which is titled The Weather Machine, A Journey Inside the Forecast, and Andrew joins us from New York today. And Bree Eggers is also with us from Boise, Idaho. She's a meteorologist at Boise's NBC affiliate, KTVB. And Bree, before I let you go here, I want to play one clip from you and just get your response, because a little earlier we were talking about apps and social media and how people have more weather information at their fingertips than ever before. So last May in Ohio, as a dangerous storm there bore down on the state, Dayton's Fox 45 cut away from its regular programming of The Bachelorette so that meteorologist Jamie Simpson could warn viewers of possible tornadoes. Then he started getting slammed on social media for interrupting The Bachelorette. And he responded. Here's how he responded live on TV.
I was just checking social media. We have viewers complaining already. Just go back to the show. No, we're not going back to the show, folks. This is a dangerous situation, okay? It's nice, right? Think about this. This was your neighborhood. I'm sick and tired of people complaining about this. Our job here is to keep people safe, and that is what we're going to do. Some of you complain that this is all about my ego. Stop. Okay, just stop right now. It's not.
Meteorologist Jamie Simpson in May. So, Bree, I mean, has anything like that ever happened to you, or is this happening more often in meteorological circles?
Oh, it happens all the time. Where are our priorities? I suppose, you know, I'm a fan of The Bachelorette, absolutely. But my job is to be a communicator, and I'm supposed to warn you about a dangerous situation that could be developing over the area. And that will always be my first priority, because that is my job. It's not just to tell you, you know, that your weather for your wedding this coming Saturday is going to be beautiful. That's a perk of my job. But my job is to have the best lead time, the best warning time that I possibly can, and to give that message, not only, hey, here's what's coming, but also, hey, here's what you're supposed to do. So it's just like you said, it's not about my ego. It is exactly what I'm supposed to do. There was a post on a board that I belong to, a bunch of meteorologists, and a man down in Alabama referenced the Lee County tornado, and he said, you know, there were too many unfortunate deaths here for the next event like this. Are we ready? Are you ready? Is your station ready? Are your microphone operators ready to give this important message so that this doesn't happen? That's my job. And quite frankly, as a fan of The Bachelorette, you can go back and watch it on DVR. You can go back and watch it online later when the event has passed and everybody has made it out okay.
Good point, Bree, because once you're safe and sound, the show is always there. Bree Eggers, meteorologist at Boise's NBC affiliate, KTVB, thank you so much for joining us, Bree.
Thank you.
So, Andrew, you've been waiting patiently here, but respond a little bit to what you heard Bree saying about the challenges of being a modern-day meteorologist, on television at least.
Yeah, you know, one of the things that I really struggled with to kind of to learn how to communicate myself was these two very distinct registers of talking about the weather. You know, there's the banal, you know, there's the kind of ultimate small talk and, you know, sort of conversation starter in so many situations. But then there's also the catastrophic. Mm-hmm. And we kind of rely on the same systems, the same apps, the same people. And there are days when it's just not that big a deal. And, you know, especially if you live someplace like Los Angeles, where it's, you know, the forecast just is the same, you know, for seems like almost every day. And then there are days where, you know, where we have, you know, absolutely, you know, incredibly significant decisions to make, you know, and the track with those is that it's not only that we have a forecast farther in advance, but we have more confidence in the forecast farther in advance. And, you know, it was amazing to look at the forecast for Barry last week against the forecast for Katrina 14 years ago. You know, fortunately, Barry was nowhere near as catastrophic a storm. But we, you know, already had at least more of a day lead time. You know, Katrina had a very good 2.5 day forecast, mm-hmm. which was kind of state of the art for 2005. And you wonder what greater confidence, what greater preparation, what different decisions could have been made with a 3.5 day forecast that we would have today.
Yeah. Well, let's go back to the phones. Andrew is calling from Wauchula, Florida. You're on the air, Andrew.
Magna, I want to thank Bree for giving us a beautiful lead in on people's perceptions. And I Andrew Blum's book sounds really, really interesting. I want to cut in a slightly different direction, though. And I want to bring up another four-letter government word, N-O-A-A. I mm-hmm. want to talk for a couple of seconds about Noah and the lady, Donna, who was on talking about weather apps.
Yeah.
You know, we have at our fingertips, both through Weather Ready Nation, through the National Weather Service, and directly through NOAA off the NOAA website, an enormous body of extremely useful data that admittedly it takes a little work to get into the NOAA website and locate stuff, but just an absolutely unbelievable wealth of information that's available to everybody at their fingertips all the time, updated instantaneously, self-updating. And so much of that information addresses those sudden changes, but it also addresses the much more serious and long-range issues that we are facing with not weather, but climate,
right.
And I really want to throw this out there. Anybody can do this little experiment for themselves. They can go to the NOAA website and go to NSIDC, and I'm sure Andrew knows what I'm talking about. The National Snow and Ice Data Center has, along with an enormous wealth of other data, there's actually a sequential month-by-month animation of the ice cover both in the Antarctic and the Arctic, but obviously the Arctic concerns us much more right now. And you can sit and watch from about 1979 on, and it takes about 8 minutes to watch the animation. You can watch the month-to-month change in the Arctic ice from the beginning of the 80s to this month.
Yeah.
And if you're ever talking to somebody who... And so many people that would, you know, say they're climate deniers really simply have not been exposed to valid information.
Yep.
You get somebody sit down and watch that animation for 8 minutes, and it'll close the case.
Yeah. Well, you know, Andrew, let me just jump in here, and I'm so sorry to interrupt, but you've actually brought up two very important points that I want to hear Andrew Blum respond to. So Andrew, thank you so much for your call. Now, Andrew Blum, let me turn back to you. We will get to the climate issue in just a second here, but when Andrew from Florida was talking about the vast quantities of information that we have, including all the data and analysis that comes to us, well, not free, but supported by the public from NOAA, it gets us back to this issue that the ability or the science of predicting the weather, as you write in your book, is a great triumph of international cooperation. That it's all this information is seen as a global public good, right? We've got American satellites, European satellites, different models coming from different parts of the world, all working together to inform the planet about the weather. Could this possibly change, though? This is a question that you ask in the book. Could it change?
Yeah, I worry that it might. You know, we have had this 150-year tradition of global data exchange. And again, the information that NOAA has is incredible. The weather observations that NOAA, the National Weather Service, make are, incredibly rich. But we, they're one piece of this entire global system. And particularly for forecast past, two or three days, we're really relying on that global system. So for about, it's really about 30, 40 years now, we've had private weather companies that have taken the government forecasts and, made them more specific or tailored them for television use or for use by different industries, and so-called the sort of value-added forecasts. What's beginning to change now is that you have private companies who are doing things like flying their own weather satellites or making their own weather models. And these things that were really before only done by governments, there's now a recognition that there's some money to be made. That if before no one except a government or even a consortium of government was going to spend $20 or $30 million in a supercomputer to run a weather model, now with new weather extremes and, of course, with this incredible success in the forecast, there's the possibility that, having an edge with your own forecast might be worth running your own supercomputer or flying your own weather satellite. And the risk then is that we have a breakdown of this system of global data exchange that we've had for 150 years, that you have new data that makes for better forecasts, but those forecasts are proprietary. And there's an end up with two forecasts for the haves and for the have-nots.
So are governments themselves wondering about where they might get their future data?
Well, at the moment, things continue along, but there's been a lot of concern about the Trump administration's interest in making sure these new weather companies can succeed. That's been signaled in a couple ways. It's been signaled partly by the nomination of Barry Myers, who had been the CEO of AccuWeather, to be the administrator of NOAA, which is the sort of parent organization, the National Weather Service. And it was signaled again this spring when Lou Uccellini, the director of the National Weather Service, longtime director of the National Weather Service, ran for the presidency of the World Meteorological Organization, which is literally the UN of weather, the UN agency responsible for weather. And a big, part of his platform to run for this, global weather post was to, quote unquote, rethink public-private data exchange. And that was seen by many meteorologists around the world and by this sort of weather diplomatic community as a moment of concern that there would be some shift from this longstanding 150-year tradition of global data exchange and more of an effort towards private observations that may not be shared, sort of put into the global pool. His candidacy failed. His German counterpart won, but it was really a sign that there is the interest in shifting this from a global public good to something done as much or more so by private corporations.
Well, and also recently, just to add one more name here, you interviewed Neil Jacobs, the acting administrator for NOAA, about this, and what did he say?
Yeah, Dr. Jacobs is a expert weather modeler and comes from one of these private weather modeling companies. He worked at Panasonic, the electronics company, and he surprised me in his interest in making sure that these new private companies would succeed and be profitable, because he was worried that if they don't, then there would be a fragmentation of the system. But it surprised me because it was a departure from the sort of the government first idea that let's see what these private companies can do for us. Instead, it was really saying, okay, how can we arrange the system in a way that they can succeed? And I suppose there is a scenario that means better forecasts for everyone. But when you look at the macro patterns of both great forecasts and very dramatic and sort of new extremes of weather, the idea that would be shared equally seems naive and problematic.
Wow. Well, let's see if we can get one more call in here. Julie is calling from Dahlonega, Georgia. Julie, you're on the air.
Hi. I was wondering, will the vagaries of climate change render useless the current assumptions on which the supercomputer models are based? Will it change? Will change affect the physics and chemistry, the predictable current physics anyway, mm-hmm. and chemistry of the weather, or will somehow they'll be able to adapt? How do they do that?
Right. Julie, thank you so much for your call. And our previous caller, Andrew, had also mentioned climate as well. So, Andrew Blum, how does that factor into our power to predict the weather?
You know, it's a great question. The models serve us very well with new weather extremes because they are not based on past weather, but they are based, you know, really in the sort of deeper physics of the atmosphere. So unlike humans that might be constrained by past experience, you know, that might say, you know, are you 40 inches of rain in Houston? That's impossible. That's never happened before. It can't happen now. The models are quite willing to run their calculations to again, verified by their 40-year history and the sort of constant testing and calibration. And they're very willing to spit out strange weather extremes. And we see that in lots of cases. And so we're really quite well served by the way in which they actually simulate the atmosphere and the ways in which the atmosphere is mixing together and doing strange and new things.
But isn't it true, though, that generally speaking in the predictive sciences that the most uncertainty is at the extremes? But if we're heading into a world where the extremes are going to be more of a norm, how do those two things come together?
It's interesting. I think because you're still talking about extremes, but within reasonable bounds of the system. And I've heard meteorologists describe, you know, they know something's really wrong when it's the model spitting out 140 degrees or 160 degrees. But Hurricane Harry in Houston was really the sort of perfect example where the meteorologist did a double take at the numbers that were being spit out, the amount of rainfall, and in fact that was what verified, as they say, that was what actually happened. And so I think we're it's ironic, I think, that we have this new tool just at this moment when we need it more than ever.
Yeah. Overall, Andrew, as you researched this book and you traveled various places around the world to understand sort of the science of weather prediction, do you think most of us, just on average, really understand a forecast when we see it? Or did you learn things about just the information that we're presented every day that you didn't know before?
I think there's still a bit of a lag in what we're willing to decide based on the forecast. I think that, you think about the first iPhone weather app 10 years ago was a day less good than our current iPhone weather app. These improvement has come so quickly that I don't think we've really caught up with its capabilities. I think the next frontier, though, is really recognizing the moments of uncertainty and the moments of certainty. There's nothing more annoying than a 50% chance of rain. But occasionally that might be the best forecast we're going to get. That might be a pretty good forecast. And it's really then up to us to make the right decision from it and decide how much it matters to us on that given day.
Right. And that whole concept of 50% chance of rain, it doesn't necessarily mean that there's a 50-50 chance that it'll rain where you're standing, but that 50% of a given area might get rain too, so
yeah, we should figure that out.
We need to figure that out. I should have asked that to Bree when she was with us. Well, Andrew Blum, author of the new book, The Weather Machine, A Journey Inside the Forecast. We've got an excerpt of it at onpointradio.org. It's a really fascinating book. And Andrew, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much, Raina.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.